everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy Tom Fairbanks. Tom, I guess the Buckmaster household, not the only ones having trouble with swarms of bees that I was telling you about our situation at the house the other day. A flight, a Delta flight from Houston to Atlanta was delayed 3 hours because a swarm of bees took up residence.
They had, they had bees on board?
Not on board. They were
darn.
The hive was outside on the winglet.
We almost had another bumper sticker. Bees on board.
Yeah, darn. Bees on board. Business class. Bees in the
So... Why? You know, you need to get somebody on sometime to talk about this.
We need a bee expert.
Why are the bees all of a sudden so prevalent? And it wasn't that long ago.
I don't know.
When we were worried that the bee population was being decimated somehow.
We do need to. Maybe we'll definitely get a bee person on because I've had some personal experience just this week. The Buckmaster Show, Thursday, May 4th. Big wedding anniversary tomorrow on Cinco de Mayo. Getting ready. All right, May 4th, 2023, our show in our 13th year. We're in the green thing, Zocalo Village Studios, 1030 KVOI, Tucson's voice. We have our worldwide live listening on my website. That's for the live stream, buckmastershow.com and kvoi.com. When we do our telephone interviews, our live line is sponsored by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. But with me in studio is Steve Christie, Pima County Supervisor. He sits on a five-member board. He represents, as a Republican, the lone Republican on the board, he represents the 4th Supervisorial District. I love saying that. He will complete his second four-year term on the board next year, and he hopes there will be a third four-year term. Mr. Christie, Supervisor Christie, still well known in our community, even though the sale happened in 2007, when Steve Christie Chrysler was sold to a group out of Phoenix that then apparently, first of all, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah. So, and I asked you when you came in, are they still involved, this Avondale Auto Group? And you said there's been several owners.
Yeah, this is my understanding is now we're in, since I sold, in the third iteration of a new owner. So this is, I think, part and parcel with a lot of the transitions that the automobile industry has gone over in the last, 15 years or so. And we've seen... I think the development, we started to see it in the late 1990s and into the turn of the century. That sounds sort of odd to say that.
I know, it still seemed weird, doesn't it? Even though it was 23 years ago.
Right. And what we're seeing is kind of a conglomeration of assets and to have efficiency with numerous locations and numerous franchises under one ownership group or one ownership management team. It's kind of sad in a way from my standpoint and my memory and my experience because I always believed in the corner hometown car dealer. And, you know, every fall you raced into the showrooms and they pulled back
the new models look
pull back the sheets.
They sure.
They used to say that that prices got so high that they took the sheets off the cars and put them onto the customers after they read the prices.
Yeah, but that was always traditionally the first week after Labor Day.
Yeah, and I remember Look Magazine and a number of the periodicals.
What do the new cars look like?
Yeah, and it was so exciting. And I think we're missing a lot of that with the technologies today and the internet and the lack of handshake and face-to-face discussion and dealing on something that's usually your second largest purchase. And I'm quite glad I'm not in the business anymore because it would be, pretty foreign.
It would be a tough time to be in the auto store business because of the electric vehicles. This transition period, it's going to be tough.
And they're struggling. The manufacturers
are
struggling.
The price point, what's it going to be like with the electric vehicles, which are still, I know I see a lot of them out there, but it's the technology may not be where it, not may, it's not where it's eventually going to be.
Yeah, and I'm all for all the technological advances in saving energy and saving gasoline and things of this nature, but I still think there's a long way to go before public acceptance and confidence in a lot of these products. I know a lot of my friends have electric vehicles, and they rave about them. I'm just concerned about being caught somewhere in the middle of nowhere without the ability to charge up my vehicle after it goes flat. So it's going to be a while before this former gasoline-powered car dealer is going to be looking at electric vehicles.
And you still drive the Chrysler product.
I still have the Chrysler. It was my wife's demo, Mrs. Wow. Christie's demo, that we kept after I sold the dealership, and I still drive it today.
We really, really escaped a tragedy on Mount Lemmon, didn't we?
We certainly did.
How close did we come?
Well, I think if it weren't for the fact that we had such talented and efficient first responders, it could have obviously turned into another disaster. And we have the sheriff's department and the sheriff's auxiliary volunteers to thank, as well as our firefighters who just put their lives out there and risk everything to protect our assets and our lives and our structures. And they did a tremendous job of responding to something that I saw a news clip of what allegedly happened, and it was very troubling. It was, an irresponsible act, given that we had a red flag warning that day, and the heat is starting to rise up in the mountains, and it's starting to dry out. But I have to say that one thing that sticks in my mind about our firefighters is their ability to surgically protect areas. And when we went through the last fire, the big one that just devastated all of the Catalina Mountain Range, you could see pictures of the Summer Haven community, and it was like somebody took a surgical blade and just outlined the outside boundaries.
Yeah.
Everything on the other side of the boundaries is devastated.
It's amazing.
But this surgical precision attack of protecting our Summer Haven community and our assets up there was amazing. So those are the real heroes in this issue, and we missed a very bad devastating.
It was the Molino Basin area that we're talking about, and boy, everybody moved so quickly on this. We had the sheriff's team, the auxiliary. Once we got everybody out of the campgrounds, that road was immediate. The Mount Lemmon Highway was immediately closed. There was quickly some helicopter drops. They got some air assets in there. They were really running against the clock, because not only was there a red flag warning that day, but the next day it was scheduled to be up to 30 to 40 mile an hour winds.
Right. Well, the other thing we have to keep in mind is this is United States Forest Service property, and they have their rules and regulations that they establish, and we were just lucky, I think, that we didn't have another bighorn fire.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that is your district. Mount Lemmon is part of District 4, so we're glad that was not a big-time fire.
This time of year, every year, we get very sensitive to the weather conditions, and it's always kind of a relief when some tragedy like we just saw, the potential tragedy is averted.
And that's the silver lining, if there is anything. This is almost like, hey, it's a wake-up call. It is. I know we had a very productive winter season. We had a lot of snow, but hey, it's warming up. That was that first 100-degree day on Sunday when all of this happened. It's also the day that our air conditioning at home went out. But that's
we had a similar situation too.
Weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, we were able to use the water to squelch the fire from the Rose Canyon area, which was very lucky that there was such close proximity. But you know, it's odd because we had such a wet winter and a lot of snowpack, and that can be a double-edged sword, because when that happens, there's more growth, and then the growth dries out, and it becomes fuel. So we have to be very vigilant to maintain all of that.
All right. Pima County Supervisor Steve Christie is with us. But before we get into another topic, it is time to talk about a topic that is very, very close to my heart. I love bakeries. Some of my fondest memories, Steve Christie, my mom would take me to the bakery before we would go down to the Wilmette, Illinois beach there on the North Shore of Chicago. We'd get some donuts and everything. And then when we'd go up in the summertime to our a little cabin that we would rent every year up in a place called Cambridge, Wisconsin, near Madison, little lake called Lake Ripley. And I always loved bakery goods. And there was this wonderful bakery there at Cambridge. And Mom really got me going on the bakery goods. And so I'm still very much into bakeries. And I know you love sweets too as well, Steve.
I do.
Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle, is my go-to bakery, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Their website is monasdanishbakery.com. 6:30 Tuesday, open at 6:30 Tuesday through Saturday, open at 7 on Sunday morning, and they take Monday off. We'll be back with Steve right after this.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com. This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. Green Things has a beautiful site over. It's over there on East River, 3384. If you know where the Brandy Fenton Park is, it's just west of that. And they've got everything for the garden, and they've expanded the business. The 13 acres also includes Zocalo Village, beautiful pottery. Boy, some of that Talavera pottery from Mexico is beautiful. GreenThingsAZ.com, ZocaloVillage.com, and they are in their 53rd year of business. They're open daily. We continue with Steve Christie in studio, Republican representing the 4th Supervisorial District on the 5-member board. Don't want to spend a lot of time about it, but it is the ongoing discussion about this. It's referred to as the call to the audience, a chance for the public to address you and your other colleagues, your 4 colleagues directly. Is this still a work in progress, Steve Christie?
No, I think it's institutionalized and something that should be protected and nurtured. To me, it's the most essential and cherished element of our political system and in our democracy. Democracy, as everybody says, can be messy. It can be uncomfortable. It could be difficult.
What do they say? Making sausage is never real pretty.
Yeah. But the important thing is that people have an opportunity, and it should be protected and encouraged for the average citizen to come down and address face-to-face the elected officials for 3 minutes and speak about whatever they want. Now, sometimes people get very passionate and worked up about things, but that's part of the process. And it's also, I think, very helpful and beneficial for the elected officials to sit there and acknowledge the fact that these folks came down on their middle of their day or the morning of the day that usually turns into the middle of the day with the way it's been going. But they have to fight downtown traffic and parking, and they're making an effort to be heard. And it's essential that the supervisors listen to them and that they are heard. And it does get contentious at times. It gets, I've been the recipient of the brunt of a lot of these discussions. And you know, you just got to look them in the eye, and you got to sit there and honor their presence and accept their and acknowledge their position and move on.
What if they throw these obscenities though out there?
Well,
how do you handle that?
You know, it depends on this obscenity, but there's ways, I think, of doing it without inflaming the situation or making it worse. Obscenities are more and more prevalent in our society, it seems. But I think the worst thing you can do is try to punish somebody by either eviction or a letter or reprimand them in front of everybody about using them. There's ways, I think, that could be utilized to minimize the effect of obscenities. And for the most part, I don't hear too many obscenities anymore.
You voted along with Supervisor Bronson, the two of you in the minority. The vote was 3-2 on updating the economic development strategic plan. And you're all about economic development. You're a big economic development guy. So what was the reason saying no to that?
Well, there were numerous reasons. First and foremost, this was generated out of the Pima County's Office of Economic Development. And I would assume that we're perfectly capable in that department with the staffing and the talent and the knowledge to be able to produce our own economic development plan. This was hired out and generated by an outside consultant by the name of Stiletto Consulting. They are a Canadian firm. It cost $110,000 of taxpayer money to produce this that easily could have been much more Pima County-centric, unincorporated Pima County-centric. It did not come close to addressing the entire county. It was all basically City of Tucson issues. Again, by someone from out of the country, and it was later admitted by the director of economic development, and I can understand what he's trying to do, but nonetheless, it was brought out that the purpose of this plan was not so much as to address the economic future of Pima County as it is to gain federal grants. It was basically a tool to be able to check off all the boxes in order to qualify for federal grants. Well, that's not a Pima County-centric economic plan. And why do we have to spend $110,000 to have an outside agency from Canada generate it? So I just thought the whole process was not a legitimate one, and it wasn't a particularly factual one in the sense that there were many areas of our county left out, and it seemed to focus primarily on the City of Tucson.
What was the reasoning about farming it out to the Canadian group?
I can only speculate on that, other than that this Canadian...
A low bidder?
Could very well be a low bidder. But at $110,000, they certainly didn't skimp on the request. But I can only say that maybe there's been some history with our Office of Economic Development and this consulting firm that prompted them to contract with them. But it seemed to me it was a boilerplate type of a plan. It really didn't raise specific issues or content about Pima County. And, you know, our folks can, we have a grants management department in Pima County administration. If we're that concerned or that diligent about going after grants, we can write our own grant requests. We don't have to spend $120,000, $110,000 with a Canadian firm to request for grants.
John Lesher, Pima County Administrator, will spend the whole hour with me tomorrow on our Friday Focus interview. We're going to take a deep dive, Steve, into this fiscal year budget, the 2023 budget, the spending plan. You have some questions about the road repair piece of this?
Well, definitely. That's part of a lot of the issues with the budget. First of all, it's a transition in how the budget is going to be going through in this year. Prior years, all the departments it was never really a budget hearing per se. It was more of a budget presentation.
Yeah,
Everybody knew what their budget was, and it was already set. And basically, it was a showcase for the departments to say, this is how it is, and this is what we're going to spend, and this is what we're going to do, and thank you very much. And that was pretty much it. County Administrator Lesher is changing all that process, but nonetheless, it's already set. It's already established. And the road plan is, of course, a very close and important factor in my elective process. I ran on it in 2016 just to fix the roads. And finally, in 2019, we were able to, by unanimous vote, come up with a road repair plan that made the promise that within 10 years, every road in unincorporated Pima County would be fixed. And that was a promise made, mm-hmm. and I feel it's one that should be kept. And the problem that we're facing now is there's been some alterations to the plan.
Are we backing away from that pledge?
That's my whole question, because I've had a discussion in a board meeting with the county administrator, and she assures us that the amount of money, some $240 to $250 million that was pledged for this plan over 10 years, will be spent. Well, that's very good, and I'm glad to hear that. My issue is I want the same kind of assurance that within 10 years, every road will be fixed in unincorporated Pima County. And I haven't received that kind of assurance yet. And if it can't be, A, why not? And B, what will it take to ensure that we keep our promise? And three, if there's going to be some sort of a shortfall due to a reallocation of the funds or a forwarding of the funds into earlier years as opposed to past or later years, if there's going to be a problem along those lines, and also the inflation and the rising costs and things of this nature that are having an effect on the road repair, then we need to find out how much is it going to cost to keep our promise. And if need be, let's get that into the budget so we can keep our promise that every road in unincorporated Pima County will be repaired within 10 years.
When was the timetable when that pledge was made?
2019.
So that's when the clock started,
That's
right?
when the clock started. We did front load a significant amount of money from years going out in order to get more roads fixed sooner, but it was not made clear that this would impact the ability in later years, from fifth, sixth, and seventh year, where there would not be the same kind of funding. And is that funding going to be replaced? Is it going to be updated? Is it going to be available? And I haven't gotten those assurances yet, and I want to make sure that, again, that if there is any kind of a situation where we can't keep our promise, we work to find out how and when and will we keep our promise.
Well, I'll try to get a clarification tomorrow.
All right.
With the Pima County Administrator, John Lesher, about where we are on this timetable.
Well, they've changed the priority now of pavement.
You're saying they kind of changed the goal line, the goalposts.
Yeah, the calculus, because basically now they're more concerned about pavement preservation than road repair. And, you know, that, I think, was not communicated properly. And, again, how does this impact our promise?
So the budget plan, and we are out of time, basically, the plan calls for spending, I think, $172 million less than the current fiscal year. Some quick thoughts about the budget, overall budget.
Well, my most current thought is, how is the county going to adjust to all of the COVID monies being terminated? And are the programs that were put into place because the COVID money was available, and the hiring of people and the establishment of departments and the expansion of programs, are they going to be discontinued, or are they, like most governmental projects, institutionalized into perpetuity? So that'll be interesting to see how we deal with that.
Okay, Steve.
Oh, I got one more thing.
What
I want
was
to
that,
tell you.
Real quick?
I love being your supervisor. Thank you.
Is that right? That's the headline there. Steve, thank you very much. We'll see you in early June. Hope you have a great Memorial Day holiday.
You too, Bill. Thank you.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana. Plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show and the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studios when we do our telephone interviews. That is sponsored by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. We're going to have an expanded half hour. Normally, we do one segment a month with Don Luce, but quite honestly, Attorney Don Luce of Luce Law Group, who's so great, we love Don, offices in Tucson and Phoenix, but Don, there's so much going on up at the legislature. First of all, good to see you.
Good to see you, Bill.
I thought, you know, I think this month we can easily expand this thing.
No problem.
Mr. Luce is our Buckmaster Show legal contributor. He's the author of two very popular books, Arizona Laws 101, a handbook for non-lawyers, which he could probably update at the end of every legislative session. If that were the case, the book would continue to be in new printing after new printing. But as it is, it's in a second printing, along with Estate Planning in Arizona, What You Need to Know. Don, why don't we begin with this this whole issue around transgender athletics in the state of Arizona?
You bet. And just to put the proper context around the subject, I think every state is dealing with the same type of issues. And the issue seems to be framed around female athletics, seems to be. And the issue seems to be framed in a way such that the people who are opposed to allowing, in this case, transgender girls from participating in female athletics, they're saying biologically they have an advantage,
yes,
over the other athletes in that sport. And I think there have been some nationally publicized articles about highly successful female athletes who have lost in competitions with transgender athletes. And so it's fueling this national debate, I think, about the role that transgender athletes should play in boys and girls sports, especially at the lower school levels, middle school, high school, that sort of thing. This lawsuit, the one that I'm going to talk about, is currently pending right here in Tucson in federal district court. And I might point out that because there is a motion pending to change venue from Tucson to Phoenix, that Arizona has only one district court. It's the Arizona District Court. There are locations in Tucson and Phoenix. The lawsuit was filed in Tucson. And in fact, one of the transgender girls on whose behalf the lawsuit is being brought attends the Gregory School here in Tucson.
Right.
So that's probably one of the reasons why it was filed here. There may be other reasons, but the plaintiffs chose the Tucson location. The superintendent of public schools, Tom Horn, who is the primary defendant in the lawsuit, very recently filed a motion for
today.
Change of venue.
Today, I think he did, yeah.
I believe you're right.
Yes.
So the defendant is asking the court to move the case from Tucson to Phoenix. Now,
yes,
it'll still be in the district court for the state of Arizona, but it'll be moved to a larger venue. I don't know what will become of that motion, but the superintendent of public schools, who's the primary defendant, apparently doesn't want it heard in Tucson for whatever reason, and I don't know. So the case itself...
Who brought the case?
Yes. Okay. The plaintiffs in the case are representatives of two minor girls, two transgender girls. They're age 11 and 15, okay? So the 15-year-old attends the Gregory School, which is a private school in Tucson, and the 11-year-old attends an elementary school in the Kyrene School District, which I believe is in Phoenix.
Okay.
So these two athletes are contesting the state law that essentially prohibits their participation in female sports, okay?
Right.
They're saying that, well, they're saying two things, actually. In the lawsuit, which was filed on their behalf, they're saying that they're being denied equal protection under the law, which is a constitutional right.
Mm-hmm.
As Arizonans and as American citizens, we are entitled to equal protection under the law. They're saying that the plaintiffs who identify and live as girls and who have not and will not undergo male puberty are similarly situated to other girls with respect to their participation on girls' sports teams at school. And they're saying by denying them the opportunity, they're being denied equal protection under the law.
Mm.
Therefore, the law is unconstitutional, and the statute which prohibits their participation should be declared unenforceable. And that's one of the claims. The other claim that they're making is that the law violates Title IX.
The federal Title IX.
Yes.
Yeah.
Title IX is a federal law that prohibits discrimination in education programs based on sex. They're saying that the state statute,
mm-hmm.
which prohibits them from participating in female sporting activities, mm-hmm. violates the federal Title IX. So they're asking the federal district court to declare the statute unenforceable and unconstitutional on that basis as well. So they have two bases on which they're challenging the statute. And as I mentioned earlier, Tom Horn, who's the superintendent of public schools in Arizona, is the primary defendant. Interestingly, just recently, two legislators, Senate President Warren Peterson
mm-hmm.
and House Speaker Ben Toma, have filed a motion in the same lawsuit asking that they be allowed to join. They want to join in the lawsuit because they say they have a legislative interest in the subject matter of the suit. I don't know what their chance of success in intervening in the action is, but they too have a motion pending in the case, just like Tom Horn has a motion pending in the case, and they're asking to be allowed to participate as interested parties. So the case currently is before U.S. District Court Judge Jennifer Zips here in Tucson. One of the defendants has asked that it be moved to Phoenix, change of venue, and two parties who are not actually part of the lawsuit, the Senate President and the House Speaker, have both asked to participate in the case because they claim they have a legislative interest in the outcome. So that's where that's at.
It would, the federal law, the Title IX, wouldn't it supersede, again, federal law over state law?
Yes. So that's known as preemption.
Okay.
The doctrine of preemption basically says the law of the federal government supersedes any inconsistent law enacted by a state, a city, a town, a village, a county.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is a law on the same subject that has been enacted by Congress,
mm-hmm.
under the doctrine of preemption, that law controls and supersedes any inconsistent law made by any lower legislative body in any location in the United States.
Hmm.
So Title IX, if that provides a grounds for finding the state statute unenforceable, will trump, as you pointed out,
mm-hmm.
the state law.
Hmm. Tom has an interesting question. Tom, our engineer producer, is Title IX enacted to protect biologically the female rights in school sports?
I would say that's a question that doesn't yet have a definitive answer. Okay. So the argument in this case is that neither Title IX nor its regulations nor its guidance purport to define sex as something that is determined at fertilization and revealed at birth or in utero.
Hmm.
So that's what the lawyers are arguing to the judge, right?
Yes.
Now, I think I think if you look at the background, you know, how did Title IX come into existence?
Yeah.
I think everyone will be in mutual agreement that at one point, men's sports, particularly at the college level, enjoyed a tremendous advantage
over
women's sports.
Sure.
So Title IX, I think, was meant to even the playing field.
Yeah.
But now it's being used to challenge a state law that prohibits transgender girls from participating in female athletics.
Let's take a break right here. It's Don Luce with us, our legal contributor. Very interesting story. We'll see how all that plays out. And it's not going to play out, is it, Don, overnight?
No.
This is going to go on and on. We'll take a break. Be right back.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. Our friends over in Silver City. Wow, just about 70 degrees midday over there. Really nice weather over in southwest New Mexico. Might be time for a road trip. Take a trip, only about a three-hour drive east of Tucson. Lots to do, hiking. Check out the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument, just north of Silver City. Their website is southwestnewmexico.org. Where to stay? Some great places over there. And no shortage of recreation opportunities. Don Luce is with us, our legal contributor. Don, let's move on to this whole idea about Arizona's, some might say, favorite cottage food program, talking about this whole deal over tamales.
Well, not just tamales, Bill, although everyone does love tamales.
Home-baked goods.
Free the tamales.
Certain homemade food, certain homemade food products. Yeah.
All right. So what we're talking about is House Bill 2509, which did not survive a gubernatorial veto. But before we get to 2509, I would like to talk about the process briefly. I think we all understand that legislation starts in the legislature. It can start in the House or it can start in the Senate. And if it's passed by both bodies, then it's sent to the governor. And in most years, the governor's office receives more than 300 bills that come from the legislature. So these are bills that have been passed by both the House and the Senate. And the governor then either signs the bill, and at some point in the future, typically, it takes effect and goes into law, or the governor can veto the bill, in which case, in most instances, it dies. But there is a procedure in Arizona where a vetoed bill can go back to the legislature for an override vote. Now, in
order— Very rare, isn't it?
It is very rare, but the tamale bill went back to the legislature for an override vote. It failed, but the process itself is interesting, and it illustrates the interplay between the governor and the legislature, I believe. So you need a non-emergency legislation, you need a two-thirds supermajority in each body, in the Senate and in the House. So you might ask yourself, why did it go back to the legislature if the governor vetoed it? Isn't it likely that the legislature couldn't garner the necessary supermajority needed for each body? Well, no, because the bill, when it passed the House, passed by a 45-11 vote. Well, that's more than two-thirds. And when it passed the Senate, it passed by a 26-4 vote. Again, well above the two-thirds needed for a override on a veto. But it failed. it went back to the House.
The loss of appetite, if you will, for the second time around is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and you might not be surprised to learn that this sort of went down on party lines. So as we know, Governor Hobbs is a Democrat. The House and the Senate are controlled by the slimmest of majority by the Republicans. So when it went up to the governor, or I should say over to the governor for approval or veto, it went with pretty big margins. Democrats and Republicans sort of agreed that this bill, which by the way, would have provided certain exemptions for certain homemade food products, right? So the trucks and the parking lots and that sort of thing would have been exempted from some of the requirements that other food producers have to comply with. It went over with essentially supermajorities. When it came back for an override vote, not all of the Democrats who originally voted for the bill changed their vote, but a lot of them did, and it failed 35-23, coming five votes short of the 40 needed for a supermajority in the House. So I found that interesting because this is such a rare procedure. Veto overrides are, in Arizona at least, are exceedingly rare. The last one happened in the early 1980s.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think the proponents of the bill thought that they could, because it had passed by such a wide margin initially, they could garner the two-thirds necessary to override the governor's veto, but that turned out not to be the case.
Let's move on and try to get some thoughts here on this universal vouchers, which one of the knocks on the universal vouchers in Arizona is about the whole accountability issue. But where is that right now with the legislature, the school issue?
Right. Well, there's an anticipated shortfall with respect to this program of about $274 million. Your listeners probably know that Governor Ducey signed into law what is known as a universal voucher program, where essentially any parent sending their kid to a private or parochial school can apply for a voucher that will pay up to, I think it's in the neighborhood of $7,000 for on an annual basis for tuition. And so when this program was originally contemplated, legislative budget staffers estimated that they would have about 14,000 requests for vouchers, right?
Turned out to be a lot more popular, didn't it?
Yeah, about 57,000 actually applied. So that created what essentially is a pretty significant shortfall. They need the money, but they don't need it immediately. The budget year ends June 30th, and the Republican legislative leaders are hoping to work out the details as they negotiate a spending plan for the new budget year, which begins July 1st. So that's fine, except the governor wants to kill the program.
Yeah, she does not like this. She wants it dead on arrival.
So you have the tension of an existing program that is underfunded, needs a lot more money, and you have a governor who doesn't even want the program to begin with. So it's going to be interesting to watch to see how all this plays out, because, of course, the governor is going to have to sign off on any legislation that comes across her desk regarding this universal voucher program. I don't know how it's going to come out, but I know based on what I'm seeing, there is not enough money to fund the program that was essentially enacted under Governor Ducey's administrative time.
We've talked about this whole issue over jobless, kind of getting back jobless pay cuts. What's the latest on that right now? Arizona's won't, I guess, get back jobless pay cuts that the governor had talked about.
No. So this actually affects about 100,000 Arizonans, right? Mm-hmm. So during the pandemic, the federal government enacted what is known as the Federal Pandemic Unemployment Compensation Program, right? A lot of words, but it means that they provide extra money to the states for people who are unemployed. So this program, which goes back to 2021, added initially an additional $600 to the state unemployment, $600 a week to the state unemployment benefit, which at that time was $240. So that was $840 that an unemployed Arizonan was entitled to receive under both state and federal programs. Now, the way this federal program works, or worked, I should say, past tense, is that the state essentially had to participate in the program and agree to accept the funds right. that were provided by the federal government. The federal money, which started at $600, was reduced to $300, but still the $240 provided by the state with the $300 provided by the federal government amounted to $540 a week, which, interestingly, turned out to be more than minimum wage in Arizona. Minimum wage at the time was $12.15. The total benefits, state and fed, were $13.50. Mm-hmm. The governor said, we're terminating, 2 months early, we're terminating the federal money. I want people to have an incentive to go back to work. They went to court, and the people who challenged the governor's decision lost. The Supreme Court this week ruled that they're not going to accept jurisdiction over the case.
Don Luce, always a pleasure. Thank you very much, Don Luce, with law offices in Tucson and Phoenix. On behalf of Mr. Luce and Tom, engineering and producing the show, we'll see you tomorrow with our Friday Focus interview with Pima County Administrator Jan Lesher.